welcome. My name is Julian Schlossberg, and the name of our show is Movie Talk. My guest today is known in the business as an actor's actor. And what does that mean? He means he can do comedy, he can do drama, and he's just terrific to work with because we worked together years ago. I'm so glad to see Richard Kind. How are you, Richard? And welcome to Movie Talk.
Thank you, Julian. And now I can tell you in person, although it's been about a year, I think I wrote to you, I loved your books. Let's start with you first. Your books were great. And to put a face to the words and hear you say, because I know you, it was just wonderful, wonderful. And I always say, and I heard you reading them. So, and I've been working out a lot in the past year. I refuse to go gently into that good night. So I work out a lot and I listened to you. You were great. I say you helped save my life because I now am healthier.
Well, so, Richard, all I can say, will you marry me?
There you go. Yes. if you lived in England, I would, because I want to move to England. I've had it with here.
I don't blame you, but we don't want to get into that on this show.
Yes, you're right. Let's talk about movies.
Let's have some fun if we can. Okay, let's go to Richard's past. Born in Trenton, brought up in Yardley, Pennsylvania. A very interesting location, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. Not that far from Philly, not that far from New York, and in Bucks County. But let's talk about your dad and mom. What were their influences on you? When you look back at your childhood, where do you think their influences came?
My dad was a big guy. He was 6'4", an outsized personality. He was in retail, but not clownish like I can be clownish. He was well-respected in his community. His sense of humor, he had a good sense of humor, but his jokes would be puns. And, I don't much like puns, but everybody loved my dad and thought he was funny. My sense of humor changed. My mom was very educated. She was an artist, taught art in high school, and then she had us. And she was a Nora from A Doll's House a little bit. She was kept a little. She was not someone who had her own self-worth until she met her second husband, who, she divorced my dad. And my dad divorced her because it was a sad thing. But she married a guy, I used to joke, he held her so high up on a pedestal that he got nosebleeds when he went up to visit her. He adored her. But my dad did not adore my mother. But they were Alice and Sam. I mean, they were just a couple. They were a couple. But everybody at the club that we belonged to, you had, Edie and Arnie and George and Gloria, they and my mom were Alice and Sam. We were middle class in Yardley. What'd you say?
Your dad was a jeweler, was he not?
He was a jewel. He owned a jewelry store. He was a jeweler and a retail jeweler. But a lot of times when you think of a jeweler, you think of 46th Street and, between 5th and 6th. And you think of the Hasid. And that's not who he was at all, because he was in Princeton. Princeton, a very goyish, white town, very educated, the highest literacy rate in the world was in Princeton. And wow. These were his clientele, and he knew everybody in town, and they trusted him. His competition literally was Tiffany's and Cartier's. They either went to their local jeweler, my dad, or they went into New York. And they did go to my dad, and my dad could get everything that those stores could get. But I was on a podcast once, a guy named Jay Kogan, who knew me, and he said, did they ever invite your dad to dinner? And I said, no. He never socialized with them. He was on the board of the theater there. He was on the board of the bank. Everybody knew Big Sam. It took 45 minutes to walk down the street with him. But he never went to their house. Never knew them socially. I know. Interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
It really is.
Yeah.
I like the fact that when you were performing, you told some interviewer that he kept asking people who worked with you, the directors, etc.
Same... Was I any good? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He couldn't sit there and say, "Oh, I believe that. I believe what he's saying. Oh, he's good. Oh, yeah, that guy, he's very." He didn't trust himself. He had to ask other people, "Is he any good?
Does he have it?
Does he have it?" And did you hear the story? I always tell the story. You'll know when this took place. He goes, "Son, did you ever see the movie Tender Mercies with Robert Duvall?" I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Why can't you act like that?" I said, "Well, why couldn't you have given me his nose?" And, maybe I got to met you halfway. But, he didn't know. He got to see me do Mad About You. But I don't know, did he see Spin City? Maybe a little of Spin City. But he saw me do Mad About You. At Second City. Second City was good.
How about Carol and Company? Wasn't that
saw me do Carol and Company. Yeah. Yeah. His proudest thing was I did summer stock out in Beach Haven, New Jersey. You know, $27 a week, non-equity. He saw me do Tebbia when I was 23 years old.
Oh, he must have loved that.
Loved it. Loved it.
Were you the class clown? Were you one of those class clown kids?
I was a funny guy to say would they gather around me because I was funny. I never saw it, but I had a group of guys who we all laughed. We all had, I think there were funnier people. Richard Bartlett was funnier. I can't say I was a class clown. You know why? Because I got all A's. I was really a well-behaved kid. Yeah, I'd talk and I'd laugh, but I was a good kid. So was I a class clown? My favorite line, of course, is Eugene Levy's. I wasn't the class clown, but I sat next to the class clown and I learned a lot. I would observe him.
Well, how does the North...
Oh, but wait, one thing. And it's so funny. Right. I mentioned Edie and Arnie. Edie and Arnie sort of were, they ran the club. They were big mucky mucks at the country club. And I always thought that they held me in disdain. So when I developed a sense of humor, they laughed at me. And that's when I wanted to make the adults laugh at me because they had more sway over me than my fellow students, my peers.
Why did you think they held you in disdain?
I was a fat kid. I don't know. I just did. Now, later on, they adored me. I mean, if you ask them, they wouldn't say, "Oh, no, we never felt that way." I felt it. And then later on, high school and certainly college, and then when I was an actor, they just adored me. Adored me.
Well, as we both know, that can happen in show business.
You think? Yeah, right. Yeah.
What was the very first Broadway show you saw?
It probably was Minnie's Boys. I know I saw Fiddler with Zero Mostel, so that could have preceded Minnie's Boys. But we're talking about a time when I used to go into New York by myself because my grandparents lived in New York. So they would take me to theater, and then there was a time when I went in by myself, and I'd see a play in the afternoon on a Saturday, and then I'd see the show at night.
Well, you were obviously smitten at a very young age.
Oh, yes. Oh, I was.
How did Northwestern come into your purview? How come you're a kid from, Pennsylvania or New Jersey, the area? How come Northwestern? What was the...
I'll tell you, that's sort of interesting. There was a guy by the name of Daniel Seltzer who ran the theater department at Princeton University. My dad was at Princeton. Yeah, my dad's store was in Princeton. So we talked to Daniel Seltzer. I met him because my dad was on the board of MacArthur. We talked to Dan Seltzer, and I bet Woody knows Dan Seltzer. And he directed like Knock Knock by Jules Feiffer and stuff like that. A brilliant guy. And I talked to him about theater and how much I loved it. But, that I was supposed to go to Princeton. My dad could get me in and my grades were good and I could probably go there. And he goes, I think he said you should look at Northwestern. That's where Charlton Heston went, and Anne Margaret, and all these people, and even Lawrence Pressman might have been brought up, and people like that. And I looked into it, and I said, you got to understand, I was a good kid. I go, yeah, I can go to Northwestern, and I can do acting, but I can still get an education.
Now, you know, I said at the beginning that you're an actor's actor, and I said how great you do both in comedy and drama.
Thank you.
I was fascinated to know that at Northwestern, you did The Apple Tree and you did The Crucible.
I did.
Now, isn't that interesting? Comedy and drama. And on top of it, some music. An Apple Tree music.
Since way back when, before it was something that I... Julian, if they say, do this part, I do this part. It doesn't matter that it's a musical or that it's Miller. You do it. That's what you do. I never thought, oh, I've got to go do a musical now. I've done a musical now. I got to go do it. It came about. Now, The Crucible came about. I actually was offered or was supposed to do Nathan in Guys and Dolls. And that was the student production called The Dolphin Show, the theater department of which I was not a member of. But my acting teacher, Bud Beyer, knew how good I was, and he put me as Danforth, the sort of the villain, the head judge, and you know, very regal and magisterial role. I did it because Bud asked me to. That's why, because it was offered to me. And yeah, I always, and there's a thing called WAMU, which was the student talent show, and big productions and a big fundraiser. I did those. I did the Apple Tree. Apple Tree was the first thing I ever auditioned for. I did it because the sign was up. Audition for the Apple Tree. I was a freshman and I got in.
Tell me, you come to New York after graduation to be an actor. How do you handle what's the hardest part of acting, I would think? Rejection. How do you handle that as a kid?
Can I tell you what the biggest rejection was? I couldn't get a job as a waiter. And I would cry. I would say, I can't even get a job as a waiter. How am I going to get a job as an actor? And I know I've always been very conscious of what I've looked like. I would have gotten laid a lot more if I were better built and were handsomer and, you know, just all the things that, you know, a kid who looks like me and was a fat kid. All the things that get to you. And I used to think, I can't get a job as an actor because I look like this. I can't get a job as a waiter because I look like this. It was horrible. That was debilitating. Job as an actor, I tried acting. I didn't expect it. I was told, you're not going to make it. You're told from a very young age, actors don't make it. So I didn't expect to.
You know, there's something these days that I've studied called the power of intention. And you had the power of intention.
What does that mean?
Well, your intention was to be an actor.
That's
and
right.
You would become an actor no matter what.
Right?
Even if you couldn't be a waiter, you were
I was going to be an actor. Well, I was an actor in acting class, and then I did all the stupid things that you do. It's the cliches. I was at, you know who Lonnie Price is?
Sure, of course.
Lonnie Price and I were in a play called Take Death to Lunch. That was the first Take Death to Lunch. I was fired after 3 days because I can't harmonize. I can sing, but I can't harmonize. I was fired. I don't know, whatever reason. Lonnie went on to do it. It was an off-Broadway piece of shit. And okay, and then I did. I was in class with Dale Robert McCausland, and I took classes at HB. And you act there. And Julian, I got to tell you something else. I sucked. I was not good. I was not good. I pulled the wool over a lot of people's eyes, but I had an energy. I'm going to say it. I'm so down on myself by saying, so please let me preface it. I know I'm not good at that time, But I had something. I had a charisma on stage that was enormous. It was something. I got better as an actor. But I had something when I was young, but I couldn't act. Okay? But I got better. You do it a lot. It's the 10,000 hours, and I became better. And I
just
did.
One of the many qualities you have as an actor that's so important for an audience is vulnerability.
Okay.
You can vulnerability. You can be compassionate. I'm going to jump. We'll go back and forth because we don't care. It's our show.
I like talking to you. I wish we were doing this over coffee. Why are you in Connecticut? Yes.
Anyhow, what I was going to say was, in a serious man in the Coen Brothers film, I have to tell you, if you said to me, pick the thing you like the best I ever did, that would be one of them. It was a terrific, terrific role. Clinton, our president, used to say, I feel his pain. Yeah. Well, I felt that man's pain. And
well,
you did it.
Okay. I have to tell you, and I mean this seriously, I have ridden the coattails of many geniuses. And the Coen brothers wrote a genius, genius, beautiful script and gave me a beautiful character. It was mine to fuck up. And I didn't. So
well,
I did it.
You did. But I mean, you've worked with some of the greatest talent this country has. You've been working with people like Woody Allen and Mel Brooks and Arthur Penn. We can talk about a lot of them, and we will buy gum.
We will.
I don't want to buy any gum, but anyhow, yes, we will. But let's go. I mentioned earlier that you were one of your early.
Okay,
successes.
Wait. I want to say one thing because it's a joke that I used to say about one of your dearest. I used to say that I lay in bed as a kid and want to be in a Stanley Kubrick movie, in an original Sondheim Prince production, and in a Woody Allen movie. Even after Stanley Kubrick died, I thought I had a better chance of being in a Kubrick movie than a Woody Allen movie. And I was made to be in a Woody Allen movie. But
and you were.
I finally did. And I have two things to say about that experience. A couple of things. Do you want to hear them now or do you want to hear them later?
Well, I'd love to. Well, we should name the movie Rifkin's Festival.
Rifkin's Festival. And you want to know something? And this, I love Wally Shawn, but I would have liked to have played that role. I think I would have been pretty good in that role. I kept watching him and thinking, and I know Woody likes me. I got so many stories about Woody. I did the scene. I had a scene, and Woody came out from the. From the monitors and everything, and he came out, and he said, "Wow, really good." And then, and everybody, when he was went back, everybody looked at me. He goes, "He never does that. He never comes out." He told me I was real good. Then I had a line that was funny, and I said it like a joke. And his words were, "He screamed it, Rich, don't hit it so hard."
Ah.
And I was absolutely mortified because I knew exactly what he meant. And I never would have done it, but I did in the horror of the moment. I did hit the joke too hard. It was written as a joke. And I hit the joke and I wanted to cringe because he was utterly right. And all I had to do, I just changed it. You know, I like being directed. But what he said to me was like a father saying to a son, don't hit it. So, of course, Daddy, you're right. Of course. It was really thrilling.
And you had to feel so bad because it wasn't something you didn't know. You knew that.
Oh, I knew I hit it too hard. I knew it. It just was my choice at that take. But he was
well,
great.
You know, Rich, I have to tell you that I've been very fortunate to have produced three or four of his plays. We've worked together, And this idea that he doesn't give notes is ludicrous.
Oh, no, yeah.
He, as he did with you, especially as you could understand from his point of view on a joke. The joke really matters. He doesn't care if you change lines, but don't mess with the joke.
Right.
That's the important thing.
Right, or don't hit the joke. Don't underline the joke. It's too good.
Either. So how does, we have to say, Carol Burnett, an icon in the business, has this gigantic successful show, and now she's coming back in a show called Carol and Company. A, how do you get the job? And B, when you get it, you must be flying high. This is going to be, could be sensational, as her last show was.
By the way, I'm going to tell you a couple of things about Carol, and one thing that I really want to say, because I want to say it aloud. Carol was so great that rather than having the casting director come out and say, Richard, next, and I was the only one standing there, Carol came out into the hallway, spread out her arms and says, come on in, let's play.
Aww.
There's nothing an actor wants more. Not come in and let's see what you got. It's come on, let's play. She was glorious. New Yorker did a profile of her about a year ago, and I was interviewed. And I said something about she takes a safe way or an easy way. She is, can't remember what it was exactly. One of the things is that she could be very conservative in the type of entertainment that she does. And this was a stretch. This was a show where we took different genres and it was an anthology series. Imagine the Twilight Zone, but comedy.
Huh.
It was an anthology. This week we're going to do a parody. Next week we're going to do a Woody Allen type half hour. The next week, Jules Pfeiffer. The next week, a musical comedy. The next week, a vaudeville. Stuff like that. And it was wonderful. But it's very difficult to produce. 22 minutes to do a different genre, introduce the characters, and tell a story all the time. Very difficult. She then decided to play it safe. That got canceled, and we went and did her variety show. And she tried again with the variety show, and it was a magnificently huge flop. She couldn't duplicate it. But I had the best time working with her. Every week, it's like it was a rep company. Truly, it was a repertory company. This week, we're going to do this genre. This week, this. It was so much fun, and she's so talented. And I sort of acknowledged that she wanted to play it safe again. She felt comfortable. And I was misquoted by this woman in the article, and it haunts me to this day that I said anything bad about Carol, but sometimes she doesn't like to go, but dramatically she does. She'll do that thing about the war. She'll do Noises Off. She did Breaking Bad. Then she did this show with Kristen Wiig. So that she will challenge herself and go in every direction. Even Annie could go do that stuff. But with the comedy, sometimes she can be more conservative than I think that she would. And it's her comfort zone. But as an actress, she'll go to the ends of the earth to take something different.
I liked her quote about you.
What did you say?
That you were born in the wrong era.
Yeah. She was lovely to me, and I'm afraid that article gave her a sour taste in her mouth about me, because I adore her, and I feel I'll go to my grave feeling horrible about how this quote was taken out of context. In fact, when the New Yorker came back and they do due diligence about every quote, I said I may have said that, but it's coming off totally incorrect. Totally incorrect.
Yes.
But it was printed, and there's nothing I can do.
as we both know, that can also be the problem of emails. You can send an email where you mean one thing and the person sadly interprets it the other way.
Yes, a nuance is not good in print. And especially the way I talk, you can hear irony in the way I say things. And then you can hear me say things that are quite level. It's terrible. But Carolyn Company, I guess, I don't want to be Pollyannish. I looked at things as, oh, this is a stepping stone. Oh, this will be good for my resume. This is good for my reel. This will get me another job. Flip side of that, no. I just like doing stuff. That's the honest to God's truth.
I love the idea that you were not born in the right era. But I have to say, I was fortunate enough to spend time with Larry Gelbart and Arthur Penn in the play Fly Fox. And when they came to me and said, what do you think of Richard Kind coming to Broadway to do the play? I said, oh, really? I mean, I've seen him, but this is a hell of a tough role. I said, if you guys feel that strongly about it, I'm in. I'll go with it. I didn't realize at that point the breadth and depth of your talent until I worked with you.
Thank you.
I'm so glad that we did that together.
Can I tell you a couple of things about that? The reason why I have done most of Larry Gelbart's plays. So Larry knew me. I also knew his daughter. So Larry knew me. Okay? In fact, I spoke at his funeral, at his memorial. Remind me, did I ever tell you that story?
No, you will today.
I will. Oh, you'll like this story. Oh, Julian, you'll love this story. So Larry knew me. I had done a show at Williamstown called The Big Knife, directed by Joanne Woodward. And I worked with somebody who was in the Actors Studio Free Theater. And Arthur was directing a show that Larry had written based on La Ronde, but in Washington. And they needed some role cast. And he goes, does anybody know a funny actor? The guy with a good sense of humor. She recommends me. I meet with Arthur, and he likes me, and I get the role. During one of the note sessions, he said, compliments. This is one of the greats. He says to the cast, why can't you act like Richard Kind? He's got the balls of a blind burglar. It was the greatest. I loved Arthur. And here's how he would direct me. I'd be going and he would be like this. Like this. That's how he would direct me. He was like a conductor. So he would be in the aisles like that. I loved him. And he was really, he did not suffer fools. And a couple of the people he did not like, and they're heroes of mine, Dick Libertini. Oh, he was so mean. He was so mean to Carol Kane. He was not an easy fellow.
I did the very last two shows he ever did. The other one was called Fortune's Fool with Alan Bates.
I saw it in Frank Langella. Great. I know.
Frank Langella. Both won the Tony. Won the Tony. So working with Arthur was very exciting for me and great that we became friends. And at the end of his life, because we lived 6 or 7 blocks away, we would go almost every day, just go walking in Central Park and talking. So it was great.
I'm dying.
Important to me. But I want to go back to Larry Gelbart.
Wait. I want to tell you one thing. In my head, the reason why I was chosen is because Sly Fox had a deep place in their heart. It was such a success. And I know that Larry was not happy with this previous star, the previous lead, so much so that he didn't even come to the opening on Broadway. That's what I heard. He did not like him. So I think what was in their heart was, let's not leave this glorious play as we remember it. Let's give it to somebody who might be able to do it some justice. That's in my head.
Well, you're probably right.
But I'm very, very, Well, we you I was lucky that I got this. That's how I got to meet you. I'm blessed that the things that have come out.
I think
okay, Larry Gelbart's at Larry's memorial, which was at the Academy, in the Academy Theater in L.A. And you know how big that is, like a 1,500 seat theater. Goes way back, and unless you're on microphone or even facing the audience, nobody can hear anything. If you're facing towards the stage, you could scream. Nobody can hear anything. Everybody there was the biggest name that Hollywood had to offer. Alan Alda, Kurt Douglas, Sid Caesar, Mel Brooks, all sitting in the front row. But they all knew him from TV and movies, right?
Yes.
There was nobody there to represent his theater work. So his daughter and widow asked me to represent his theater work.
Ah.
I didn't go on long, but I said a few words. But as a tribute to him, I did the first speech that Sly has in Sly Fox, you know, when he's talking about the glories of money. You know, gold, God with an L, gold. And it's a gorgeous, it's poetry and wit and the wit of Larry Gelbart. It's 3/4 of a page. I should have done a quarter, maybe a little more than a quarter, maybe a half. But I did the whole thing. Halfway through, from the front row, Mel Brooks screams out, "They're bringing out the hook, Rich!" I got heckled at a memorial by Mel Brooks. Now everybody says, weren't you upset? And I go, look at the story I have for the rest of my life.
In looking at the younger Richard Kind, when you look back, were you very ambitious, do you think?
Like you said, I was driven, but I can't say I was ambitious. Although, yes, I was. I think that's what I did. I knew some ambitious people. I don't think I wore my ambition on my sleeve, but I wore my desire and my dreams on my sleeve. I think I really wanted to. But like I said, I just wanted to work. I remember the first time I ever turned down a job, I thought I would never work again. How dare I? Who turns down work?
Well, for a man who wanted to work, if you ever sit down and count all your credits.
Right.
you ended up taking care of the Judeo-Christian ethic.
Yes, I did. I like working. This year, you know, I did the producers in London, and now I'm going to go do Edna in Hairspray. And in between, I'm a recurring character on a new show. You know, on a show with Claire Danes and Ewan McGregor. It's all I do. I work. I love it.
And you love it. And you've made it in the way no person maybe could have predicted, but you did it. That's the thing. Now, I want to talk to you, if we can, about a few things that I really want you to know that I saw. I saw you do The Big Knife. I saw that production. And I have to tell you, having sat through, God bless him, Rod Steiger needed a director. If he was left to his own devices, he'd eat the scenery. And that movie, he ate the scenery, he ate the cameraman. I've never seen any performance.
Unlike anything in the world.
Outrageous.
Outrageous. How about, you know he wears a hearing aid in the movie.
Yes.
There's no call at all for a hearing aid. So the only way I can justify it is that he knew how big and loud he would be. It's because he was hard of hearing. So he had to talk loud.
Yeah.
It's the worst performance in the world. Oh, it's awful.
And what you did, what I loved you did, and somebody said this is not original for me, said he was a mensch and a monster. And I thought, hey, that's a good description of Richard in that role.
That. Oh, that's great.
Isn't that something a mensch?
That's bad.
Not since M&M candies have I heard two good M's.
Julian, that's so good. It's so good.
But
so
Rich,
good, yes.
I want to ask you, Joanne Woodward, I was lucky enough to spend some time with, one of the finest people in show business
I ever met. Both of them.
Oh my golly.
Did you know Paul?
I did, but I didn't. We didn't exactly hit it off. He was kind of very aloof with me, but she wasn't. And she was very excited to spend time and talk because I had taken Orson Welles' Othello. It had languished for 40 years, and I was able to bring it back and rescore whatever. And she knew Welles. They had done, I guess, Long Hot Summer together.
That's right. Yeah. Right.
And she just couldn't get over what I had done. So I was golden. As far as he was concerned, I was not golden.
Oh, that's funny. Funny.
Yeah.
Have you heard my Paul Newman compliment?
No, tell me.
It's the best. This is along with Arthur, who directed Paul in the Left-Handed Gun.
Yeah, first movie.
And an actor's studio. I'm coming out. We did it at the small theater at Williamstown. And I'm coming out the stage door, and somebody jumps on my back. I'm not kidding. Jumps on me from behind. Arms around my neck. I'm choking. And he whispers in my ear, "Kid, you're like a locomotive. Once you get going, there's no stopping you." And it was Paul Newman. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And Joanne allowed me to sit the entire scene. You would think that a director would have you get up and go around, and she didn't. She just said, she was great. She was great. I loved her.
I'm so glad to hear it.
Oh, I loved her.
What people don't understand is know that the character you're playing, Clifford Odets, based on Harry Cohn. And Harry Cohn was a terrible guy in many ways.
Right.
But you look at the output of what that man did at Columbia Pictures, getting Frank Capra. You know, Mr. Deeds goes to town, Mr. Smith goes to Washington. It happened one night, From Here to Eternity. Come on, Bridge on the River Kwai. Look at these movies. And he was considered low in the totem pole of studios. And yet he won Academy Awards after Academy Awards.
Yeah.
So something was going on with Harry Cohn.
He was a horrible... He was the mention of monster.
What are you looking for, Richard, in a director?
I love to be directed. I love it. I want to be told what to do, and that help because I'm lazy. I come out and I do what my decisions are, and I'm going to bring it to you. Take what I'm giving you and say, I see this, but let's move it over here, and let's get it over here. That's the challenge, that's fun. That's playing in the sandbox. Don't let me just go, I like rehearsal better than I do performing. Tell me what to do. And if it doesn't work, then we'll try something else. I like to be directed. I like people to say, no. And I'll go, and I'll argue. Oh my God, I'll argue. I'll say, no, it's got to be done like that. But then if they can convince me, then I'll move that way. And I love it.
We've talked about Arthur Penn and Larry Gelbart. Let's talk about Clint Eastwood, Hereafter.
First of all, let's say this. That movie's a piece of crap. However, the first two scenes of the movie, unbelievable. That tsunami, I've never seen anything like it in my life.
Nope.
That was CGI at its beginning. I wonder what it looks like today. I wonder if we can look at it and go.
I was so knocked out by it that I have to believe it still would stand up.
I remember it comes and it just takes over that beach and the it was unbelievable. Have you heard me tell the story about working with Clint?
No.
I got a couple of things. All right.
I like the fact that you've got something in your quiver.
Oh, I do. My God.
Of course.
Okay. The camera is here. I'm talking to Matt Damon, who's across from me. So they have the camera on me. The camera gets this much. Okay. This is the frame of the picture. Okay, this is the end of the frame. Right here, sits Clint Eastwood next to me on the couch. He's this far away from me, but he's out of the picture. And he's looking at me. He's looking at me like this. Like this. And I'm going, Clint, what the fuck? But I don't say it out loud. But I'm going, I'm acting here with my... He's this far away from me, outside of the frame. That was daunting. I kept wanting to go, listen, Icon, get away from me.
Yeah.
Now, here is the very funny story, and let's...
Before you leave, yeah, Rich, what? Before you leave that story,
yeah.
Do you have any idea why he was doing that?
Because he doesn't go to the monitors. Because he wants to see what's in your eyes. What are you saying? He knows the words. He can hear them. He wants to see what the... It's moving pictures. He wants to see what the picture's going to be. He was looking in my eyes, seeing, what does my face show? He doesn't have to see it on a monitor. He looks at the actor and sees, is it real? Is that the
That's
reality?
Really intimidating, to say the least, though.
It was unbelievable.
We talked earlier about it took a while, but you became a pretty good improviser. And I want to ask you, you worked with one of the greatest improvisers in Robin Williams in The Angriest Man in Brooklyn.
He was very sweet. He was not that funny on set. I think he was getting to the point. He had just agreed to do the TV series that ended up being a tremendous failure. He must have been looking towards a future that we now know he had. I think with his illness and with his age, he knew Jonathan Winters. And Jonathan Winters used to go to this parking lot in the Valley and just stand there and talk to people. And the first time you talk to him, you go, geez, I'm talking to Rob, to Jonathan Winters. Wow, this is unbelievable. And then the next day, you're talking to Jonathan Winters. Okay, Jonathan, I got places to be. And then the next day, you're in the parking lot. And Jonathan, please, I can't talk to you. I can't. And I think he saw his future in that he needed to always be fed like Winters. He knew that he was cut from the same cloth. And he always needed to entertain. And I think he was very, I think he was sad. I think he was sad at what lay ahead. And he was not funny on set. A great actor. And, of course, funny in the role. Well, not that funny because it's a sort of serious movie, although I've never seen it. But he was very good and great to work with. But he was loved. God, he was a lovely guy. Lovely. And he acknowledged that Bonnie Hunt was the funniest person around.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I went to the opening of Waiting for Godot. Mike Nichols directed with Steve Martin.
I saw him.
And
Ron
Williams, F. Murray Abraham, and Bill Irwin. And at the opening night, I was with Robin. I didn't know him. We got to talking.
Sure.
And he told me a story that was so shocking to me about the business that I never forgot it. And that he was doing Mork and Mindy. We know how big a success that was. And he told me that the way he found out the show was canceled was reading it in Variety. Can you imagine that? I mean, to me, it's bad enough that it's a tough business. We both know that. But you think somebody would go to him and say, gee, I'm sorry. And I'll tell you something. This is years later. He's still angry at that particular story. And I was truly shocked at it.
It's awful. Awful. The sort of, I thought you were going to tell me the Jackie Mason story. You know that? He was on a TV show, and he pulls into his parking space, and his name is taken down from the parking space. That's how he found out the thing was canceled.
By the way, I for a short time, I was Jackie's manager.
Were you?
One day, yeah. He was so smart, so clever, wrote his own material, didn't have writers, and really... deep. I mean, as funny as anyone I ever met, truly.
Really?
Anyhow, it was, I quit, and it's a whole story, and it's in one of my two books. I don't remember.
Yeah, it's not, okay. All right. I'd remember it, but and I no, yeah, I don't.
Tell me if you can, because I'm really interested in knowing, was there any time you wanted to quit? Was there any time you said, no, I this is too much. I got to go, not to the jewelry store, but, you know, never.
I said, well, what I always wanted to do was be Darren Stevens from Bewitched. I wanted to be a PR guy, a Madison Avenue guy. That I would have been happy doing. I would have been very successful, I think, within my dad's business, because I like people, and my dad sold nice things. He said, people never buy jewelry for a sad occasion. It's always happy. I would have enjoyed that. I never, never, never thought of quitting, because Julian, I always worked. I never made money, but I always worked.
Wait a second. You're not going to tell me that on Spin City,
Especially Spin City, I did not make money.
Really?
Never.
Wow.
I have a very dear friend who's now a famous producer, but a guy named Grant Heslov. He's one of my dearest friends.
Oh, yeah, he's George's partner, right?
Right. I go way back with Grant. Grant, when he was an actor, had a pilot. Spin City was my fourth TV show. In my third year of doing that show, Grant got a pilot and was getting more money than I was getting on the third year of Spin City. We were very underpaid at Spin City, because when we got it, it was, everybody knew it was going to get on the air because it was Michael and Gary David Goldberg. So we were sort of a guaranteed 13. So take the money or sorry, you don't get it. And they really lowballed us. The four of us really got very little money. Very little. It happens. I'm a character actor. I am a character actor. And we are, I always say about me, I've said about, you know, I'm parsley on a plate of meat and potatoes. So people have heard that, but will people lay down $18 to $24 to see me in a movie? No. But when I show up in a movie, they're happy. But they're not going to lay down the money to see me.
They're not laying down the money to see almost anyone these
now,
days.
Well, no, okay. But you lay down money to see the biggies and even some of the mid-levels. Okay, well, they're not going to get 20 million, but they'll get a million.
But you've seen the biggies have huge flops. It doesn't necessarily guarantee it.
That's correct, but they'll take the gamble. Me, they won't even take the gamble.
Well, I understand. Would you say, in looking back in your career, was there, because I've heard often from my friends who are actors, that sometimes you get a role and you know it's not really working the way you want, but by the end of the run, you finally got it, and you're so frustrated because it took till the end to do it. Right. Has that happened to you?
Are you talking about a play or a movie?
Play.
Yeah. Oh, I drive now thinking, oh, what I should have done with some of the lines that I do every night. But driving or walking down the street and going over things, that's how I learn lines. Walking down the street is how I do it. I'm still going over lines in my head in the producers, and I'll never do it again. But I miss it so. I love it.
What a role.
Yeah.
Tell me about, this must be such a huge kick in your head, about playing Max Bialystock at the Hollywood Bowl. I mean, it boggles my mind.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
That must be to come out to this huge theater.
It's unbelievable. When I did The Producers about 23 years ago on Broadway, okay, I've done it three times now in three very different venues. One was the St. James Theater, which is 1,400 seats. And you're screaming to the corners of that theater. It's huge. You go do it at the Hollywood Bowl. Now, when I did on Broadway, the first line is, the reviews come out a lot faster when the critics leave at intermission. Very funny line. Funny line. I was playing to Asians and Iowans then. Everybody in New York had seen it. Everybody who was sophisticated, who had a wit about them. It was tough to get a laugh on that line. So I'm at the Hollywood Bowl, and Gary Beach, who did the original Roger Debris in Producers, I said, how did Nathan say it? How did he get a laugh? I did. And Gary goes, just say it. And I go, Gary, it doesn't work for me. It was tough. Okay. He goes, just say it. I came out. And you know those turbine engines from a airplane? Yes. I came out and said, the reviews come out a lot faster when the critics leave it in. Boom! Like a turbine engine. 18,000 people laughing. And I'm doing a different play. But it's to 18,000 people. But I'm mic'd. But I'm this small on a stage this big. I'm this small. So that was very different. But I still had to be big. I could still hear the laughter very much. It would wash over me. When I did it in London, 700 seats, and I'm right here. I'm right on top of them. So at the St. James and the Hollywood Bowl, I'm talking to the heavens at the Garrick. I was right there. So when I say, I used to be the king of, I'm talking like I'm talking to you. I used to be the king. I had to do it. I used to be the king. At the Garrick, I was doing, I used to be the king of, it was wonderful, intimate. It was like doing it in a black box, even though it was 700 seats. So each place I did it was a different max. Same lines, different. It was different. Now, 23 years later, I got to relearn it. I had to acclimate myself to the performance that I was giving. But that was a great challenge. You just don't go right into and just do it. It's different. It was different.
Well, that's one of the hottest roles in all of musical theater.
It's great.
Mama Rose and Max Bialystock. Those are tough.
I'll tell you something. They used to do Springtime for Hitler, and everybody thinks the show is over. I had four more songs after Springtime for Hitler, and one of them was Betrayed, which was the number where the 11 o'clock number where he goes through the whole show. Yeah, it was
unbelievable. If you probably saw, I'm sure you saw the movie The Producers. I don't know if you saw Nathan do it.
Sure.
But I'm wondering, do you think you leaned closer to Zero or closer to Nathan?
No. I'll tell you something. When Harvey Fierstein left Hairspray, I wasn't well known at the time, but I was a working actor. I had the opportunity to audition for the role of Edna. I said, I can't do it. Harvey is it. I couldn't come close to what he's doing. Nathan, to me, was a combination of Phil Silvers and Jackie Gleason. By the way, something I heard, Jackie Gleason was offered the Zero Mostel role in that movie, and he wanted too much money, so they went with Zero Mostel. Seems unthinkable today, but he was. Nathan glides. He's so good. He's just smooth. He's wonderful. I mean, he was great. He was slithery, and he was a producer like that. You know, I was a gargoyle. Blah blah blah. I was much more of Zero. Nathan is adorable. I mean, he's not handsome, but he's adorable. I ain't so adorable. And Jackie Gleason had that Irish good looks. And Nathan has that patter, that the fast patter that Phil Silvers had. And I think he was closer to that. I was closer to Zero. So when I had the opportunity to do audition for The Producers, I leaned more towards the Zero Mostel of it. But The Producers couldn't be The Producers if you didn't have Nathan because he created the role. He helped write the thing. He demanded that they have an 11 o'clock number because he got to do nothing after the first act. So he was responsible for the success of the producers. He was great. He was great as Max, and he was great in helping. I couldn't have helped Mel the way that Nathan did. Nathan was a stand-up first. He did it and put his thumbprint on it. I just did a different version. And I am a forceful person. And I'll tell you, teaching improv, I only teach beginning improv because I'm afraid that I will meet a Robin Williams and I will put a hamper on his talent by telling him, do this. But to get him started, I can do it. I can tell him all the rules. But when you're really flourishing like a Robin Williams, he'd be so much better than me. I might stifle him. And I would hate to stifle talent. Say
is watching you as, even though we don't call it a board, that you were still number one on the call list on Sly Fox. You treated everyone such as a gentleman. Never threw your weight around. You were so warm and loving to the other actors and even your producer that I just want you to know, I think you'd be a hell of a director.
But you're calling me the star, the number one. We get out there when we play and we have fun and we create. If we get together, we don't create negative, we create positive because we create together. And I know this sounds a little sermonized, but we create together. We all come together. If I were to be higher than thou, we wouldn't create together.
Well, that is wonderful and idealistic, but we both have been around enough years to know it doesn't always work that way.
I agree with you, but I'm saying this is what I'm... George Clooney, who was, and I never bring him up, but he's the same way. Without putting it like that, but certainly as a director, everybody will say there's no better set than when George is directing. It makes fun. And he stands up for people. If somebody is mean to somebody else, he gets in fist fights with the director, famously.
Yes. Well, I purposely have stayed away from George because I'm sure that's, after a while, gets you enough. How about it's other enough. Things? But I am interested in just one thing about that.
Go
and
ahead.
Then we can close and let you have dinner.
Okay. You know me. I can go on forever.
I know, and we'll probably do that off the air.
Yeah, sure.
Tell me about Bennett Brothers. How did it happen? What were your aspirations? Did you think there was something real special happening here?
Yeah, I'll tell you about it. I don't talk about it, but Bennett Brothers I'll talk about. George was in Chicago doing a play called Vicious at Steppenwolf, and on a Saturday night, the cast comes to Second City. So George comes to Second City. He's watching me for an hour and a half. Then he sees me improvise. Then we go out for beers and play pool. And then he leaves, never to be seen again. Cut to over a year later. I get hired. I go into audition for a show called The Bennett Brothers. And there's an actor who I won't mention, but he's been hired as the good-looking brother, and I come in and I go to network with him, and it's obvious that my energy is overpowering him, and they like my energy better. But they hire me, and Tom and I do the thing on a Wednesday. You get 10 working days to do a pilot. On Friday afternoon, after rehearsal, I get a phone call. We're firing Tom Bird. We're going to have somebody else come in. You'll meet him on Monday morning. His name is George Clooney. Okay. We wanted to have him sooner, but he's in Kentucky at his sister's wedding. Monday morning comes. I come into work. There's this guy, Rich. I don't know who the hell he is. I don't know who he is. I met him a year ago, and he watched me for 2.5 hours. I wasn't watching him. He was in the audience. I was acting. I don't know who this guy is. We were drunk in a bar. We were playing pool. The bar is dark. I don't know who he is. He goes, I saw you taking. I don't know. We became friends. He was ambitious and hardworking. And we thought this was our ticket. We thought we were going to be great. This was going to be unbelievable. And we worked really hard to make this show great. We would rehearse at home. It was great. And we thought that we were going to be huge. The best thing that ever happened to both of us was that it wasn't picked up. But at the time, we didn't know it. But we thought we had the new Odd Couple. And of course, we didn't get picked up. We were despondent. We were so devastated. And the show was Brandon Tartikoff's idea at the time. So we don't get picked up, but we remained friends. He lived in L.A. I went back to Second City. This was like in April. He said, you got to come out here. You got to come out here. I didn't come out until the following January. I came out because Chicago got cold. It became what's called a benefit season, meaning that theaters were, evenings were bought by charities who wanted to put on a benefit, and they were the worst audiences in the world. So I said, all right, I'll leave in January, February. And that's when I went out to L.A. and got my job right away. And it was George kept me out, and he showed me the ropes and introduced me to all of his friends, Grant being one of them. All my friends were, and we've remained friends since those days. And we remained friends. But Bennett Brothers, we wanted to have happen. We thought we were brilliant. We thought we were the new Abbott. We thought we were Abbott and Costello and Laurel and Hardy and Felix and Oscar. We thought we were glorious. We weren't. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe we were, but we weren't picked up. Yeah. Best thing that ever happened to us.
Well, before I say goodbye for the moment.
And you know I want to keep talking.
Oh, listen, yeah. I'll call you tomorrow.
Yeah,
right. I want to ask you, in looking back at this so many decades that you've been acting now, plying your trade, character actor or not, you've played plenty of leads. Even if you consider yourself a character actor, you've done a lot of leads.
On stage, not on TV or movies, but on
That's
stage.
That's right. But that counts, you know. It counts.
It does count. But the reason I do it is because economic consequences of me as a lead are not as great in theater as they are in movies and TV.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true. I want to ask you, in looking back over these decades, if I said professionally, what would you say were one of the two or three biggest highlights of your career as of now?
Second City. Bing Bong and Inside Out. And if you ask me for a favorite role or a role I'd like to do again, I'd love to do Travesties by Tom Stoppard. Oh, you want to, can I tell you something? This is
Please.
A wonderful, this is a wonderful, I think this is such a wonderful story. Travesties starts off with a 35-minute monologue, solo monologue, talking about Vladimir Lenin and Tristan Tzara and Oscar Wilde and James Joyce, all in this. It's a wonderful thing in Switzerland after World War I. The play is all about a man who lived with these great geniuses and thought that he belonged in this town, that he belonged with these people. And you find out that he's actually a nobody. He's a little gnat in the world of geniuses. He means nothing. But he's arguing. He's telling the audience, I'm somebody. So that's what the end of... So the beginning monologue is, here's who I was with, and I was with Oscar Wilde, and I was Tristan Tzara, and the genius of Vladimir Lenin. We would meet in the library, and we would get together. And he didn't. And he's in a crazy house. He's in an old age, probably a crazy house. The last monologue is him saying, I was there. I was there with these people. I was there. Acknowledging that he's nobody. And I didn't realize it. And about four performances in, all of a sudden it dawns on me what the last monologue means. That I'm nothing. I'm nobody. And it didn't hit me during rehearsal. It hit me while I was on stage. And I go, I literally, like, I'm taking the audience by the lapels, and I go, I'm somebody. I mean somebody. My purpose. I belong in the world. And you realize he doesn't. And I started sobbing. And this 6-minute monologue took about 8 or 9 minutes because I realized on stage, I came to this realization and I just started crying. And it was the most cathartic thing. And then the next night but it was a realization that I go, I was there. I was, you don't understand. I was just sobbing because I felt so bad for this man.
And I'm assuming you never, ever got back to that part again, that you could do that. That was that one night, right?
It was that one night. Oh, no, I have control of myself. I would be imploring to the people and saying I meant something. But then that Richard Kind felt the sadness and the pity. And so it was Richard Kind saying, oh, my God, I realize what I'm talking about. I stopped. I was sobbing because I was a man at the end of his life saying, I'm nobody. I don't mean anything. It made me so sad. I got to do it and implore the people and say it like that, but I was sobbing at the end of it.
And do you think there was any similarity to that and a serious man's role?
Sure. Loser. A loser. Oh, God, yes. The humanity of these loser people, yeah.
And this is what you're able so well to portray in all your beautiful work. Whoa. You're able to do that vulnerability and compassion. And that's because you're a vulnerable, compassionate fellow. Anyhow, thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure for me.
That's my pleasure.
Thanks for joining us on Julian Schlossberg's Movie Talk. Remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Produced by Audavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world. Produced by Audavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.